Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. Around 95% of the world's rare earth minerals are being processed in China at present and making it some of the most strategically important materials in the global economy. And boy, have we seen that as a result of some of the global and geopolitical tensions that have unfolded of late. I'm Jimmy Moyaha. This is the SAFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at Pepkor's decision to expand their fintech offering with a 20 billion rand acquisition. We speak to the Fintech Association of South Africa's chief operating officer, Danielle Lawrence, and get her thoughts on this particular transaction and what it could mean for the Pepkor group. Then we speak to the team at MSC Cruises taking a look at the continent's tourism sector and what it is that we can look forward to in that respect. A lot has been unfolding on the African continent, and we're going to see if we can make sense of what has been taking place there. We also have a conversation taking a look at the world of new energy vehicles, but with a greater focus on the implications that could have on the jobs market. The National Association of Automotive Component and Allied Manufacturers is concerned that we could potentially be losing jobs in that respect if we do not manage that transition to new energy vehicles more carefully. We're going to speak to the CEO at NACAM and get a sense of how it is that they are seeing this conversation at the moment. And then, because it is Wednesday, we've got an executive lounge conversation. We're going to be looking into the life of the chief country officer at Deutsche Bank South Africa, Danielle Mazia. She joins me to give us a sense of how it is that she found herself in the role that she's in and what it is that she enjoys about it.
The day's markets. Understanding the moves and making smarter investment calls.
As always, that's where we kick off the show with a sense of some of the market movements that have been unfolding throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by Otto 1890's David Shapiro to take a look at markets and see if we can make sense of them. Uncle David, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for the time. Local CPI data, not US, South African CPI data came out today that I suppose we were anticipating a number that was less than attractive, but just how bad was it?
Bad. You know, at 5%, I think it's the highest certainly that we've seen for a long time. I think 2 years, just reading some of the commentary. And it's also the fourth month of acceleration. So at 5%, we're almost writing in now 25 points, another 0.25% rate hike. I don't think the governor can hold back now if he's going to stay true to his 3% target. So that's going to put us under pressure and just take us a step backward. In fact, I must say that the bond markets, and I'm talking about the long end of the market, the 10-year South African bond, it kicked up a few points, but not dramatically. So I think to a large extent, we've discounted that, we would see higher rates. But overall, it puts more pressure on us. But Jimmy, we've got three different markets in South Africa. So, you want to ask me to comment on the market? I'll say market number one, number two, number three. See.
What do those markets look like, Uncle David? And why do we have three different markets?
Well, the nicest one or the most, in fact, we ended up on the day. And that's really because we saw a turnaround in commodities or platinum, palladium, silver, gold, all of those were up. Oil up, which is not in our favor, but I mean, that kicked gold shares a lot higher. So we had some big gains on that side. Harmony, Anglo Gold, Goldfields. Now that market is related to the dollar, to a weaker dollar and also to higher, just generally a move into commodity prices, as call it safe haven or whatever, however you want to describe it. So that market was very strong. The mining market. Then we have the 10 cent market. That's our two big stocks, Nice Person Process. So we had Tencent in Hong Kong down 7%, which is the biggest fall in over a year. Why? There's rotation out of Tencent. You try and explain that. I don't understand it. But also gaming revenues weren't that great. So what did we have? Our two big stocks, Nice Person Process, both of those down 4%. that's an influencer also on the on the industrial market. Then we have the inflation number, and that knocked our retailers. So we had everything from Pick n Pay, Foschini, Clicks, Mr Price, Dis-Chem, all of those coming under pressure, largely because high interest rates means that consumers under pressure. So there you are, you have to balance all three. But overall, we were up.
Uncle David, we were fortunate enough to be up. Some of the other markets aren't as fortunate. I looked at Asian markets, the Hang Seng struggling along, and I suppose that 10-cent sell-off potentially having to do having something to do with the sentiment in Asian markets. European markets were the complete opposite, though. They were up on the day.
Yeah, I that's also difficult to understand why European markets are up as strong as they are. And it's funny when you see in certain areas, where they are picking up. We're seeing pharmaceutical business. I think they perceive to be cheap. And it's hard to describe it, but for whatever reason. So we are seeing money flowing into some European. We've seen it into the banking sector, a lot of the industrials, those that are related, with power and energy. Even some of the luxury companies are picking up at the moment. So Europe, okay. And the US is neutral. You've got fears now ahead of Alphabet's and Tesla's numbers coming out today. This year, we see all the big, I mean, this week, we see all the big tech companies starting to report. The results are going to be good. That I can tell you. But we've got schizophrenic, markets at the moment. While the results are going to be good, markets are still, or commentators or investors, still very skeptical. We're still getting this debate about the sustainability of the AI theme. Is it real or is this just enthusiasm? So we have to, Jimmy, we get this how many? Every 3 months. So we get it 4 times a year, like the seasons. So we have to just negotiate or navigate our way through it. But overall, the numbers are going to be good in absolute terms.
Speaking of things that we get regularly throughout the year, Uncle David, we're in the middle of earnings season. We know we've started off quite strongly in the US. US markets continue to enjoy a bit of optimism, I suppose, around how it is that they're faring at this stage. What are you making of the numbers that are coming out there at the moment?
They're very good. They really, that's underpinning the markets is just corporate earnings. On the other hand, you've got oil prices now. What's Brent's over 90, 93, 94? That's got to have some impact. So it is holding back other elements of the market. But over, so you've got very good tech earnings. On the other hand, you've still got high rates. So if you look at the bond markets in the US, they're reflecting that inflation's going to, it's going to damage the economy. Rates are going to go higher. In fact, the 10-year there is still very high. Against the backdrop of higher corporate earnings, you would have expected bond markets to be a little easier, but not at all. So there again, you've got different, you've got different personalities in all these different markets. If I'm not making sense, that's why, because it's very hard to make sense of everything, of all these different movements, and trying to connect the dots, they don't connect.
They certainly do not, Uncle David. If we're looking at the oil price above $90 a barrel, that does connect, and it connects with the tensions in the Middle East. We thought that we'd have a de-escalation of these tensions at this point. We've been hearing from the White House repeatedly that the war is over, or that an agreement has been reached, or that the oil price is set to come down. None of these have proven to prevail. At what point does the market then stop being optimistic about the situation and genuinely just start to fear again? Or is the market just pricing everything in?
That's a difficulty, because where's this collision going to take place? This collision of the AI optimism and the wonderful results we're seeing, the money being spent by companies as they develop the infrastructure. On the other hand, you've got this other economy where prices, where oil remains high, interest rates are relatively high in the United States. They're not coming down. That is hurting consumers. When they go to the pump and fill up with gas, it's expensive. So when does this collide? That's what we're waiting for. So I say you've got these, these two different highways or roads, you know, some, even though they look parallel at the moment, I think somewhere along the line, you know, they could bump into each other.
Uncle David, can we take a look at the rand? That seemingly
Yes.
is surviving a lot of the movements. It has clawed back some of its losses against the British pound, which is nice to see every now and then.
Yeah.
But it is still holding quite firmly against the US dollar, which if we are to look at the US dollar at the moment and we're looking at something like the dollar index, the dollar basket, the Dixie is on the up. So you would anticipate that there might be a bit of a weakening in the rand. But I suppose
Yeah.
with the anticipation that that interest rate hike will happen on our side, it narrows down our interest rate differential between us and the US at the moment.
Yeah, and it's firm. You wouldn't believe it against a backdrop of higher inflation, you know, of a weaker economy. But I think this is the dollar, you know, so it does reflect that dollar weakness that you're talking about with the higher price of higher price of oil, and also the belief that, you know, Mr. Trump and his policies are, you know, going on a collision course that creating this massive amount of debt, which somewhere along the line, has to transform into some action or whatever that action is going to be. So there is that fear, and that's dominant. So the rand at 1640 is surprising all of us. And the other thing is, as I mentioned earlier, when we saw the inflation number coming up, and we expect rates to go, that our long bonds are steady. You know, not doing anything. So money is flowing into that. They are appealing, and I think that's an alternative to the, alternative to the dollar. So there you are, Jimmy. You're trying to explain it. It's un and I mean it in all fairness. It's very difficult to try and explain the different characteristics of these markets.
Uncle David, before I let you go, I'm going to put you on the spot. You mentioned that we're all but certain that a 25 basis point hike is on the cards for us. We know that decision will be tabled tomorrow, at least delivered tomorrow by the central bank. And you also touched on the fact that that puts us under even more pressure in our local sense. What do we then need to do to perhaps alleviate that pressure if we are to go with the assumption that this is inevitable, this will happen? How do we go back to conversations around growth when the interest rate cycle doesn't look very beneficial towards that?
It's that, you know, it's very difficult because generally you'd want to work harder, you know, in other words, increase productivity. But I think this is out of our control at the moment. If you look, what really drove inflation higher was the transport cost, well, fuel. You know, up 34%. I mean, that's from the last year to this year, and likewise transport. So that's where it's starting to reflect, and it's beginning to filter through our economy, and it's very hard for us to reverse that. We just have to save more and work harder. I know it sounds ridiculous, but and pray, you know, that oil prices do come down, and we start to see those commodity prices ease a bit, because that will give us a huge amount of relief. But you know, you got Trump. I don't know. Anyway, you know, you can just throw up your hands in exasperation.
The markets are certainly in for a faith-based conversation over the coming weeks, as we hope to see markets potentially do a little bit better than they are. For now, we will have to contend with the uncertainty that exists in the market. Thank you, as always, to Uncle David. David Shapiro of Otto 1890 joining us to try and make sense of some of the market movements and where we may be headed.
With a complete view of your finances, Nedbank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, Nedbank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. Nedbank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
Imagine if you could save time like you save money. A second here, a minute there. Type a little faster, walk a little faster. Or you could stop scrolling on the internet. Just think of all the hours you'll save. Now what if you could take all that time and invest it? Watch it grow. Until eventually, one day, you'd have so much time that you wouldn't know what to do with it all. But unfortunately, time doesn't work like that. It can't be stored or banked. And unlike money, you can't make it back. That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time to do whatever you want to do, even if it is scrolling on the internet. Ellen Gray, long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The Pepco Group is doubling down on its fintech ambitions. They've recently announced that they would be consolidating their existing fintech business with another fintech merchant, creating a new super fintech business with potential hopes of having this listed at some point. We're going to be exploring this in a bit more detail with the Fintech Association of South Africa's Chief Operating Officer, Danielle Lawrence. She joins me on the line now to see what we make of these developments. Danielle, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Your initial thoughts around this particular transaction, certainly an interesting one, especially in a fintech market that is increasingly becoming more and more competitive.
Thanks, Jimmy. Lovely to be here. Yes, it's absolutely I think it's a really positive move. For a number of years now, we've been saying that fintech's biggest opportunity isn't simply about digitizing financial services. I think, you know, that's where people think fintech ends, but it's actually about making more accessible and more inclusive financial services available and embedding this into people's everyday lives and businesses. And this is exactly where this is going.
Danielle, if we have to look at the mechanics of this sort of transaction, I mean, we often deal with transactions where companies come together, companies buy out other companies, there's conversations around mergers and anti-competitive behaviors and all of that. But the fintech space has always been a little different because it allows for businesses to almost build different parts of a fintech and then bring them in together to form a new kind of fintech business. Is that what's happening here? And is that how you're seeing perhaps the broader fintech landscape?
Yes, absolutely. So I think we should start by saying that obviously there is some sort of concern from smaller fintech businesses when these sort of transactions tend to happen. And the concern is usually around competition. So they wonder whether they will be able to compete. They wonder if this is going to destroy the fintech market. And there is that sort of concern that comes naturally with it. But the reality is that innovation doesn't just come from, let's say, a balance sheet or one singular transaction, but most of South Africa's successful fintech businesses actually start by solving one problem exceptionally well. So large businesses like this transaction will bring the scale, will bring the distribution, will bring the capital, and the smaller fintech businesses will bring the agility and the innovation and the specialized expertise. So from a mechanics perspective, I think that fintech itself is not about owning a payments capability or owning any particular type of capability. It's about bringing the ecosystem together around a transaction, around a consumer, around all of these elements. So this transaction is going to be one component that can unite an ecosystem if it's done in that spirit, which I think from the onlook of it, it is.
Danielle, if we look at the broader fintech landscape in South Africa and we look at this particular market in comparison to other African markets and even other international fintech markets, how do we rank against our global peers, against our continental peers? Are we innovating enough in the landscape that we can see meaningful growth in the fintech world of South Africa?
Yes, absolutely. So South Africa, interestingly enough, is quite unique globally from a fintech perspective. We have one of the most sophisticated financial technology sectors in the world. We have a really world-class payments infrastructure. We have progressive regulators, and we have that very strong fintech ecosystem. I think our challenges around financial inclusion are similar to other emerging markets, but our regulatory and banking infrastructure are comparable to many developed markets, which is really, really impressive. That combination makes South Africa really attractive in terms of fintech innovation and investment. What's interesting is South Africa is not particularly, from our perspective as FNASA, interested in trying to copy this, Asian market or broader African market or European market or US market. We're building fintech solutions that are unique to the South African requirements, which is that financial inclusivity and that access part. And the informal economy, the SME enablement, these are some of the biggest opportunities and where the greatest fintechs are born. So I think we're a great market for this, and we're definitely scaling and growing so much so that we can hold our punches against some of the international markets for sure.
Danielle, before I let you go, I want to take a look at the mechanics behind the Pepcore transaction. I mean, we know that under the new business that's being created through this merger, we're going to have Pepcore retaining the majority stake in that. And you touched on the fact that we often find that some businesses, big or small, have different things that they bring to the table. Some perhaps bring agility, some bring resource and balance sheet. If we're looking at a transaction like this, and we're looking at what this type of transaction then does for the investment case into fintech in South Africa, how then do we use what we're learning from these sorts of transactions? Understandably, still a transaction that is in the works and on the move. How then do we start to, perhaps as fintech innovators in South Africa, or even as smaller fintech businesses, how do we start to leverage these type of transactions into attracting more investment into South Africa's fintech market?
Great question. I think, you know, if we look at this from a mechanics perspective, the reality is that Pepcore probably could have quite easily acquired Shop to Shop outright. They could have, you know, put some money on the table. And instead, they've structured this as a combination of businesses where the products that are being kind of absorbed into this one unit are going to retain a meaningful stake, and they're still going to be able to service the market that they service. And that tells me that this isn't just a pure acquisition that is going to be closed loop and where investors look at it and go, oh my word, now we're going to have to buy up the whole of Pepcore if you want anything done within fintech here. Actually, what it shows is this growth and potential investment story, because it gives the indication that larger players are open to collaboration with the fintech players in the informal and formal sectors. And that opens up opportunity for other businesses to do the same thing and for investment to do the same thing. So from a fintech ecosystem and investment perspective, that is super important. I think this brings a lot of scale. I think it shows that South Africa fintech assets and businesses are worth investing into and are worth looking at from a collaboration perspective. And I can't see any environment where that is a bad thing or where that is going to deter investments. In actual fact, it should show that the market is ready for these kind of collaborations to happen, which should attract investors at the end of the day.
Fintech businesses aren't only born out of Silicon Valley. They can be created right here at home in South Africa and on the African continent. And with the innovation that we have on this continent, this is how we build some of the solutions that we desperately need for this continent. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to the Chief Operating Officer at the Fintech Association of South Africa, Danielle Lawrence, for joining us to take a look at Pepcore's decision to merge their fintech business with Shop to Shop to create a new, bigger fintech business and what that means for the world of fintech.
With a complete view of your finances, Nedbank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, Nedbank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. Nedbank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
With the growing popularity of new energy vehicles and South Africa's own transition objectives to new electrified vehicles, and potentially as part of our just energy transition ambitions, one would think this would be the great area of opportunities for South African jobs. However, the team at the National Association of Automotive Component and Allied Manufacturers are concerned that the introduction of new energy vehicles could potentially pose a risk to existing jobs that are already in the market. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the CEO at NACAM, Renee Muthilal. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of these developments. Renee, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Where does the area of concern come in here from a jobs perspective, particularly in the automotive space? I thought the introduction of new energy vehicles was going to be a good thing for the job market.
Thanks for having me, Jimmy. And I think you actually contextualized it fair enough. And there are opportunities. Having said that, the reality is that South Africa does not have a demonstrated history of production in the NEV space. And many countries are already in that market in terms of producing those vehicles. It is important that at some point our domestic production environment transitions into scale production of these NEVs. They are starting to emerge in pockets, but not at any level of significant volume. So the opportunity exists if we are able to transition the domestic manufacturing value chain, in particularly the component space, to produce a range of new energy vehicle components to replace what are slowing nodes of production in our traditional strength, which is internal combustion or ICE production. So let me just kind of summarize the initial comment in that the potential for significant job loss exists if we do not proactively put in place the policy and other business support measures that will assist the South African industry to transition into a multi-pathway or technology approach, including the new energy vehicles.
Renee, that sounds like that leaves an area of opportunity still available in this particular market. And you touched on some of the factors that need to be looked at if we are to make the most of this opportunity. I want to get your thoughts around where policy sits on this, because that forms part of how it is that automotive manufacturers choose to invest in South Africa. And we know that in the past, things like policy uncertainty have been a dampener to the automotive sector. If we are to have a blended life where internal combustion engines and new energy vehicles coexist, particularly in the South Africa's context, what needs to happen from a policy perspective?
So I think it's really key. South Africa, just like other destinations where there's significant autos manufacturing, relies on industrial policy and a range of incentives. I mean, if you compare us to countries like Thailand or Mexico, Morocco, all of them have some level of state support. So we should not shy away from the fact that A, South Africa has a long history of producing automotive products, both vehicles and components, but also a long history of government support and necessary to continue to ensure that we maintain the levels of production that we have. Having said that, I do think there are a few key areas that policy needs to be re-looked at and recalibrated in some way. We are, as a sector, right now going through a review of what is known as the SA Autos Master Plan and the APDP policy framework. What we have noticed is, despite significant investment from a policy side into the sector, we've almost had a local components production or localization environment that's effectively stuck in the mud. It's been at about 40% for the longest time. And that really needs to be unlocked, particularly as you talk about these move to new energy vehicles. We really need to ramp up to get closer to the 60% target, which is the global benchmark for competitive value chain propositions. So what does that mean? The APDP needs to be recalibrated to almost be a little more overweight on supporting production in the components sourcing by OEMs and less towards what we know as assembly or just kind of pure assembly of vehicles. So that's a really key policy update that we think is needed. We also need to find a way of unlocking the domestic market. And I do think there is some space for policymakers to get creative in how A, greater levels of South African-produced vehicles find themselves being driven by South Africans. Right now, we've got a heavily penetrated vehicle market where Somewhere between 67-68% of vehicles sold in the domestic market are imported. So what we really need to do is to start seeing a shift back towards a more balanced supply of South African produced vehicles on the domestic market. I do think we then need to start looking at issues around preparation of skills and technology. One of the encouraging findings out of our research was that many of the existing manufacturing skills can easily transition into new frameworks of production, whether that's something like NEV production or other new emerging technologies. I think of something like automated or advanced driver systems. If we are able to build the skills base and technology base to ensure that South Africa is participating meaningfully in those parts of the value chain, I think we would have made significant progress. And then ultimately, investment in any new technology follows certainty. And you made the point about policy certainty. Manufacturers, both vehicles and components, make investment decisions today for products that get onto the market in 5, 7, 10 years' time. So the stability of an industrial policy is really important. But long-term security of that policy framework equally key. So announcements around what happens post-2035 start becoming important right now.
There is definitely opportunity to make the most of new energy vehicles in South Africa, and it does not necessarily mean we have to do away with internal combustion engine vehicles either. It just means we have to find a policy that works for both. We have to find a market. We certainly have the employees and the labor force to be able to accommodate new jobs in the automotive space. We'll leave the conversation on that note. National Association of Automotive Component and Allied Manufacturers Chief Executive Rene Muthilal joining us to take a look at the transition to new energy vehicles in the South African automotive space and how that could potentially be a catalyst to creating more jobs.
Sure, it's great knowing my net worth's denominated in dollars, euros, pounds and rands. But that's not why I'm a client of Standard Bank Private. This is surprising my bro in the States on his birthday.
It's not what you do that matters, but who you do it for. Get an offshore account with 4 currency options and pay no monthly maintenance fees. Search Standard Bank Private for more. Standard Bank, it can be. Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So with the recent announcement by the Industrial Development Corporation that they'd be looking to invest into Mozambique following Mozambique's tourism sector increasing, I thought we'd take a look at the broader African tourism market because we are in peak season for that market in some areas. And who better to do this with than the team at MSC Cruises? They host almost all of the cruises that we know on the African continent, and they have some really good offerings there as well. I'm joined on the line by Managing Director at MSC Cruises South Africa, Ross Volk, to take a look at this and see what to make of it. Ross, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. It's been a while since we've caught up. How has the African tourism market been performing, or at least how have you been seeing it as a business?
Well, thanks, Jimmy. It's a great privilege to be on the show, and yes, it has been a long time. You know, I think trends are recovered from COVID, and we're seeing some growth. But, you know, with the turmoil in the international markets at the moment, it is a bit of a challenge in terms of how we see tourism going. People are a little bit reluctant to book. They want to see where things are progressing in the future and what happens with the developments. So it has been a strong season, and it's been one that's been very good for us overall. But, you know, things could always be better if we had more stability globally and certainly within the country as well, looking at some of the unrest and the challenges we faced in the last couple of weeks.
Ross, how much of the uncertainty has had a significant dampener on the African market? I mean, a lot of the conflict has been directed away from the market, but of course, with the conflict comes destabilizations and disruptions, and that affects generally how people wish to move around the world. How has the market been faring, especially since the start of this year?
Well, certainly, you know, South Africa in particular, but Africa in general is quite resilient in terms of its travel requirements and what it tolerates. So it has had an impact, but it hasn't had as significant an impact as, you know, one would have possibly expected. The fuel price does have a big impact on the overall spend availability of households, which is something we need to obviously factor in terms of it. So I think passengers and travelers are looking for value, which cruising represents a phenomenal value proposition for that. And that's why we have seen some resilience in that sector in terms of that. But, you know, the uncertainty around where to travel, when to travel, you know, what is it going to look like in 6 months' time, obviously creates some kind of buffer that we would want to not see, and we'd rather have the stability that would give people certainty to be able to make those bookings and book much longer in advance. So, you know, as I said, you know, we've been resilient because we provide a very value proposition orientated holiday destination with unique offerings. But certainly as a collective tourism industry, we've seen some kind of hold back in people wanting to travel and spend the money.
Ross, let's look at some areas of growth. Where have you seen some interesting markets that perhaps have come up on the African continent that have shown a growing interest? South Africa, obviously, remaining one of the key markets on the continent. We've seen from our own data that suggests that there is still very much an appeal behind the South African market. Outside of our market, where else on the continent are people visiting and perhaps looking to travel to?
Look, I think Mozambique and Namibia form part of a very big triumvirate of positions in the continent in terms of the coastline, the beaches, and the offerings they have. And I see a lot of positivity in those areas, and certainly why we balance ourselves into Mozambique as one of our premier destinations from South Africa. We're seeing a lot of inbounds on going on cruises from the likes of Uganda, Kenya, Tanzania, and as far afield as Nigeria, Ghana, and places in West Africa. So, you know, I think there's this general pull to want to come to South Africa and to these places, and the pull from a Mozambique, Namibia, and South Africa perspective, given our infrastructure and our overall beauty that's inherent within that coastline and those respective countries.
Ross, let's talk inclusive tourism. This is becoming a growing trend for some markets that have been under a lot of pressure, and I suppose it forms a good foundation if we're looking at long-term market resilience. What does that even start to look like? I'm guessing it's not as simple as just saying to individuals, hey, South Africa's a great tourist destination, but a lot more needs to be done, I suppose, perhaps from a partnership perspective. How does inclusive tourism start to build into how it is that we build a resilient tourism sector?
Well, I think it's twofold, and I think your question needs to be classified in two areas. There's the inclusivity in terms of making sure that no one's left behind in the economy that generates and benefits from a tourism activity. So, you know, again, from an MSC perspective, we have a very strong ethos in wanting to look at buying local and supporting local, and that is part of our value proposition and our overall procurement strategy within the country. And that inclusivity from a travel perspective needs to be uniform across, you know, all of our offerings, as well as the country's offerings, to make sure that no one gets left behind. In terms of sort of a wider inclusivity of the space, is that cruising can't happen without infrastructure at a port or infrastructure within a city. And that is what needs to be invested in to create an inclusivity that allows us to have a resilient destination, as well as a very strong marketing principle about why come to the destination you're marketing. So, you know, for me, that inclusivity on that side speaks about, you know, what is our strategy overall from a perspective of, do we have internal hinterland infrastructure that can host people of large volumes? Do we have the port infrastructure? And have we marketed the destination effectively to bring the people to this beautiful country and the beautiful region that we're operating in, so that we can then host them and make it their home away from a home? And that's really the two sides of that inclusivity story that I think need to be looked at separately.
Ross, if we're looking at the tourism lens on the African continent, how much wider do we need to make it? Because a lot of the misconceptions, I suppose, around the African continent is that when you come to Africa for a holiday, you're coming for the safari and that's it. But yeah, the truth is, on the African continent, we have diverse foods, we have diverse cultures, we have diverse heritage routes, we have all manner of things, to the extent that we're now attracting business events, conferencing, because individuals want to come and host their events here. Perhaps that has something to do with our hospitality and how hospitable Africans are. But if we are to look at broadening the tourism lens of the continent, how do we start to reposition that towards the global market?
In my opinion, it's a threefold exercise. It starts with, you know, how are we bringing the infrastructure and tying it together, the air, sea, land, as well as the infrastructure in those areas that we are offering. So it's not only to Kruger, Cape Town, Masai Mara or the Serengeti, for example. It's infrastructure in areas where we know we've got the natural resources to complement our offering. It's then looking at our marketing strategy globally in terms of how we're marketing it so that we change the vision of what people see Africa as and change the vision of what they need to embrace. You rightly pointed out the different cultures. I mean, just within South Africa, we have, you know, 11 official languages, which effectively have a broad spectrum of cultures within each one of those languages. What a beautiful place to be and what a beautiful place to come and visit, because you're never going to get bored. You're going to see all of these things in their full color. So, you know, we need to do that infrastructure. We need to look and focus on the marketing strategy around it. And then we need to make sure that we are excellent at what we do. So we cannot accept that mediocrity is the new normal. We have to look at it and say, if we want the world to come to Africa, we had better make sure that Africa is as good, if not better, than the rest of the world in terms of our offering. And not just say it, we actually mean it. And that's an important characteristic that we need to go and factor into our decision making across the board.
The African tourism landscape is certainly one that continues to draw appeal from international markets, and with good reason. We have everything of the best on the African continent, and it is for us to showcase that to the world if we are to strengthen the tourism sector for this country and for the rest of the continent. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Managing Director at MSC Cruises South Africa, Ross Volk, joining us to take a look at the tourism landscape on the African continent.
I'm Nobukhanya Mdambo, the host of MoneyWeb's small business podcast, Mzansi Business, built around the real voices of South African entrepreneurs. This is where the conversation becomes real, where business owners share what it actually takes to build, not just succeed, but survive. We shine the spotlight on local businesses, their challenges, growth, and what it takes to succeed. Each episode becomes a moment of truth, a decision point, a lesson, a turning point in a real business journey.
The podcast delivers deep, honest conversations with entrepreneurs navigating real decisions. This is where trust is built.
Money, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It is Executive Lounge time on a Wednesday, and this is the part of the show where we get to find out a little bit more about some of our leading executives and unpack some of their interesting insights beyond their day-to-day responsibilities. This week's executive is somebody that has been recently appointed to a new role but has been within the same company for over two decades. We're going to be speaking to the Chief Executive Officer and Chief Country Officer of Deutsche Bank South Africa. She also sits as the Chief Economist for the CEEMEA within Deutsche Bank, Danieli Mazia. She joins me on the line to get to know her a little bit better. Danieli, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. There's a lot of chief roles in your current designation, but I can imagine after as long as you've spent at Deutsche Bank, this would probably be inevitable for some. Congratulations.
Thank you, Jimmy. It's lovely to be with you today. Yes, a lot of chiefs. I get it. But in our world, at a German bank, I guess, you know, having been at Deutsche Bank for 16 years, so let me just correct you on the two decades, it is a journey that has really taken me from, you know, owning the South Africa call, eventually growing into a more emerging markets role, and then heading up the other economists in the region, which is CEMEA, the Central East Europe, Middle East and Africa. And I think with that came the opportunity to step into the CEO role when my predecessor, former Saloshni Pillay, had left the company. I have been on a succession slate for the last 2 years, so the opportunity came by. And now I double hat effectively, maintaining the coverage, but not from a South African perspective. Quite sadly, as a country owner, I run the franchise and therefore need to be completely independent from a research perspective. And that sometimes would be difficult if you're also running the business. So my economist role is now looking a little bit more north into sub-Saharan Africa and then the Middle East.
Danieli, I know you've just started, but which do you enjoy more? the research component of what it is that you do or the executive aspects? I mean, you've been in other executive roles before officially stepping into this role. If you are to kind of pick between doing all the research or sitting through the boardroom meetings and the stakeholder meetings, which do you enjoy more?
Well, they both have come with their advantages, and I must say I enjoy both. It's been a real challenge over the last couple of months, but in a good way because, you know, when I have to pick, I wear the same hat all the time, right? I like to think about stories. I love to think about connecting themes across various parts of the world that we look at as economists. And now I guess it is a great advantage because it helps me to really leverage these themes and how to make them relevant for South African corporates, South African institutions, and to spot the gap. You know, transitioning from an economist comes with a lot of advantages. We really look at, you know, different angles. And I think as a sell-side economist, you often, you know, get paid to spot the gap in the market. And this is exactly the role that I have currently. From a franchise perspective, where can we add value? What is an undertapped opportunity? So I really think I'm going to be enjoying both and have a lot of fun with that.
Danielle, speaking of fun, your last name, Mazia, is Italian. Does that mean you can clarify and finally settle the debate for South Africa and everybody else as to whether or not pineapple belongs on pizza?
Oh, you've touched on a very sensitive spot there. So, yes, I'm married to an Italian. And here's an interesting fact before I get to the pineapple debate. But my husband is also my competitor, at least until recently. He's also an economist at one of our competitor banks. And it's been a real journey over the last, call it 16 years, to have him and myself neck and neck with a lot of the calls that we have. But let me tell you, he's finally got that all to himself now as I'm stepping out of the and away from the South Africa call. But when it comes to pineapple on pizzas, you can actually ask my kids. Apparently, you'll get banned in Italy for asking about pineapple on your pizza. So we certainly do not entertain that idea, but I must say secretly when I'm at a kid's party, I don't mind smashing a slice of Hawaiian pizza myself.
That secret will stay safe between us. We will not be sharing that with anyone. Danielle, let's go back to that competitiveness. How does that work? How does working in the same industry, almost in identical roles, as you mentioned, across the same financial landscape, how does that drive conversation between you and your husband? Are there fights? Are there what we'd call healthy debates? Or do you just publish your work, he publishes his, and then may the best publication win?
Well, it's been the cause of a lot of tensions annually when, you know, the surveys get done. Let me tell you that much. But a woman always has to protect a male's ego. So let me just step off of that for a moment. No, we do have fierce debates, but we've learned over the times to really respect each other's opinions. Let's just say often when it comes to the Reserve Bank and its meetings, the calls can sometimes diverge entirely. I might call for a hike and he for a hold, and then it gets really tense around the dinner table, I won't lie. But clients often laugh and say, well, as a family, you're always hedged, I guess. But over the time, it's been a source of support in a big way because being on the sales side has often, it comes with its challenges, right? You spend late nights, you do sometimes have to, you know, forfeit a weekend. And it would be very difficult sometimes. And I wonder if I was married to someone else, how much rope would I have had to really push my career as far as I had? So I've been really fortunate to have had him as a partner, but also as a competitor to, you know, have a sounding board and to bounce off some of these ideas. So it's really been to the benefit and to my advantage, I'd say.
Danielle, secretly, just between you and I, do you believe you're the better economist?
Here's another narrative. We actually studied together, and I tutored him for a couple of quarters at our university. And regardless of whom is better, he knows ultimately who actually lectured him for a couple of those sessions. So the foundation starts with a successful woman, I would say.
Well, the evidence is irrefutable at that point, and that's where we're going to leave that particular topic. Dunnelly, you touched on the foundation beginning with women. We're about to enter into Women's Month in the country, and there are many young women out there that aspire to be a Dunnelly in corporate, holding her own, being the leader of international organization as recognized as Deutsche Bank. What words of wisdom would you have for them? What would you like to share with them if they're looking to be inspired a little bit more than this conversation already has?
So this is a real tricky one, because I think as a female coming into often a male-dominated environment, and especially coming in as a young analyst, you often think that you do not have that voice. When you are starting out, you assume everyone in the room clearly knows more than you do. And because they've been around for longer and they've seen the cycles, often you keep quiet. And I felt that exactly in the early years when I started out. But here's what I learned. You may have not seen the 20 cycles, and you may actually not come with the richness of history, being an economic historian. But what is in front of you is ultimately the facts that you look at. And I found that the best insights often comes from the person who wasn't learned what was supposed to be true. And so, you know, don't ever underestimate the angle that you could bring to a conversation. Simply because you haven't been around doesn't mean you don't have something valuable to offer. And I think the second thing is to really ask for feedback. So real constructive feedback, not validation necessarily. I guess, you know, we sometimes feel that we are affirmation bunnies, almost wanting to be rated first and how good you are. But the actual issue here is rather to pay attention to how you solicit feedback, how you ask questions. Because sometimes in the act of asking a good question, you actually realize that you've had the answer all along. And here's the important thing that it taught me. It actually teaches you to trust yourself. So don't swallow your insight just because you're young. Ask the questions, because ultimately you build up a view that helps you to trust yourself, to trust your own view, and to have that greater conviction in time. And I think that would be a nutshell from what I have learned over the years as advice that I can pass on to young women.
Certainly some sound advice coming from someone who has been in the industry for a significant period of time and has managed to use that time to carve out her own voice in a market, in a world that requires that voice to be heard. We'll have to leave the conversation on that note. The Chief Country Officer, also Chief Executive Officer at Deutsche Bank South Africa, Dunnelly Mazia, joining us for this week's Executive Lounge.
Did you know that South Africa has one of the highest crypto adoption rates in the world? Fact. With that comes massive innovation and new opportunities. Stablecoins are the new buzzword in the industry. These are crypto versions of the Rand, the Euro, and the US dollar. But what's coming is even more exciting. Being able to borrow against your crypto and buying tokenized real-world assets such as stocks, wine, football teams, and real estate. Join me, Kieran Ryan, on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast each week to stay on top of what's happening in the fascinating world of crypto.
If it's about Africa, then it's our business. Catch the Business of Africa podcast with myself, Duduzile Ramela, here on MoneyWeb on the 4th of April and every fortnight after that. We are on the following platforms: MoneyWeb website and app, Iono, Spotify, and YouTube. Please remember to like, subscribe, and share.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
That's the update for today, folks. If you've missed any of our conversations, of course, they will be made available as podcasts for you to catch up on. It is coming up to 7 o'clock, which means Greg Gose and the SAFM News team are standing by with the latest round of evening news. They will, of course, be followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team with the latest in sport updates. It also means from my side, good night.